Hello and welcome to the 27th episode of the On Point Speech and Debate podcast. I am Nuria Luft, a TP debater from Region 8, and today we have a great episode where Luke interviews Ethan Tong about moot court. Make sure to watch till the end to see everything that he has to say.
All right, and I'm John Gardner. I'm also from Region 8, and it's been my life goal to come on Luke's podcast, but unfortunately, I'm not quite good enough for him to interview me, so I'm just doing this little weird introduction thing. And since I put about as much time into prepping this introduction as I have into prepping moot court this year, this is all I have to say. But stick around to the end to get to the hard-hitting questions, including one for Ethan, which is, Luke, why haven't you made more podcasts? Anyway, thank you for watching.
Hello and welcome back to the On Point podcast. Today I'm joined with Ethan Tong, and Ethan is actually the head coach and the founder of Blackstone Moot Court, which is the premier moot court coaching organization in the nation. In addition to moot coaching, he has coached Lincoln Douglas Team Policy Apologetics. His students have also routinely placed at the national level. Ethan is a recent graduate of Hillsdale College. He has a philosophy and religion degree. Ethan is attending Truett Theological Seminary at Baylor University, who is now pursuing a Master's of Divinity. So thank you so much, Ethan, for coming on the show and sharing your insights on the moot court realm.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Luke.
Of course. Well, tell me a little bit about yourself, maybe more specifically about your NCFCA career, because I haven't heard too much about that. What did you do in your NCFCA career that maybe led to your interest in moot court?
I did a lot of NCFCA, though I would not say that I was as successful as of a competitor as I am, I think, as a coach now. As a student, I competed in basically every speech event. I did 2 years of LD, 2 years of TP, and 2 years of moot. Moot was my best event. I made nationals both years that I did it and got an oral advocate award my senior year. But honestly, I was not that good at debate. I thought I was better at debate than the freshman when I was at debate. But that happens a lot with high school students. So funny thing is, I broke freshman, sophomore, and junior year in debate and made it to outrads and regionals my sophomore year. And then I didn't break it all my senior year. I had a very funny NCFCA career. I also got like, I think, 9 second places before I got a first place. So that was also a lot of fun. But yeah, I had a very interesting up and down NCFCA career. It was fun though.
That's interesting. And then with moot court deals a lot with law and all of that. And are you actually pursuing anything law related, or is that just one of the interests of yours, moot court?
I originally was interested in possibly pursuing law, and I realized that it was not for me when I heard the horror stories of how many late nights all my law school friends were staying up for. But what kind of kept my interest in moot court, especially this year with the First Amendment, is that I worked on an internship. I did an internship with First Liberty Institute, which is a religious freedom organization, last year, and that was a phenomenal experience. I worked a lot with First Amendment, so I got really familiar with Smith, which is, you know, as you know, or people who are in the moot world know, on the docket this year. So had a lot of experience with that, and that's kind of what kickstarted and continued my interest in constitutional law.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting. I'd say with someone as involved with moot court as you are, I'd assume that you'd probably have more of a foot in law for like further down law. Further down the line for your career, but yeah, so that's too interesting, especially the internship event that you had. But with your NCFCA career, I think most people, they would say that it's generally been beneficial for them, and I'm sure you can agree it's very beneficial. But if you had to narrow it down to one thing, perhaps like give a very non-cliche answer about something that you learned from NCFC or just an experience that you had, but maybe try to be as non-cliche about it as possible. You got one?
Yes, I hate being cliche, so I hope that's right up your alley. The thing that I learned most from NCFCA was being self-aware. In the sense that you don't realize your flaws until other people point them out to you. But the better you get at identifying your flaws before other people point them out to you, the better public speaker you are. Because if you're always going on feedback, like a judge says you speak too fast, so you slow down. And then a judge says you speak too monotone, so you increase your inflections. If that's your process, is entirely just responding to what other people are saying, you may take a really long time to adapt because people aren't going to give you the feedback that you need. Like, judges are not always commenting on everything that they don't like about your presentation. And you just have to get good at realizing the flaws in your presentation before other people do. And so because NCFCA, everything is so tight in terms of, you know, the difference between first, second, and third place is a hair, you get used to focusing on the small things that might make a judge upset, that a judge may not like. And the little words that you use in your speech, the hand gestures that you use, the volume of your voice, all of those kinds of things, you have to adapt before somebody tells you. Otherwise, you'll just be behind the curve. So I think being a self-aware speaker, which comes with recording yourself, listening to yourself, but being a self-aware speaker is the biggest thing I learned from NCFCA.
Yeah. And you mentioned with self-aware speakers, not all speakers are self-aware. They just look for what the judges tell them, fix this, fix that, and then they fix it accordingly. But self-aware speakers go out of their way to see what things they can improve about themselves before a judge points them out. Because like you said, there's a hair of a difference. So what do you think is what made you a self-aware speaker? Since obviously it's a desirable trait to have, right? To become a better speaker. What would you say is like something that made you self-aware? Is it the desire to become, I guess, even better past the point of what judges notice? What's the story behind that?
I had a lot of friends who were very picky with themselves, and that kind of rubbed off on me. And when you have friends who are noticing their own flaws, so for example, one of the biggest things that I notice is that people have filler phrases. We know to eliminate filler words and to not say and but we a lot of times have filler phrases, even like a lot of times can become a filler phrase. But at the end of the day, I believe that, we as the affirmative team contend, and we use that phrase whenever we don't know what to say. And I had a lot of friends who would point that out to me in other people or in themselves and say, that's really not good. That, you know, this person is an overrated debater because this person uses this phrase so much. He's actually not that good of a speaker. And when you see that kind of, I would say like pickiness, but it's not in a negative sense, but it's just kind of a perfectionistic, competitive attitude about being the best speaker possible, that rubs off on you too. So I think just noticing those things in other people was really helpful for me.
Yeah, especially like the environment part. The environment and who you surround yourself by definitely is a great deal of how good of a debater you become.
Yes.
If you have good debater friends, or at least debater or people who are passionate about debate, that will also, you know, kind of guide you in your debate career. So yeah, great insight there. But let's talk a little bit more about moot court this year specifically. And if I remember correctly, you wrote the packet or helped write this packet, right?
Yes, that's right. Me and Anthony Severin and Maria Gerber all contributed to this packet. It was great.
That's great. This is your first time writing the packet, or have you written the packet last year?
I had never written a packet before. This was the first time. In fact, NCFCA had not written a packet in many years. I don't know all the details, but I know that at least the last maybe 3 or 4 years, if not more, we have been using the American Moot Court Association's packet. So we just buy a license and then we just distribute it. But part of the thing this year was I told Anthony and Maria, my students are itching for something that is new, not something that they've seen on YouTube. Because you know all the championship rounds for AMC
yeah.
on YouTube. And last year, we already knew the arguments in fifth and eighth because we had seen them discussed at the highest level. So I wanted to give the students something a little bit different this year. And Anthony and Maria, you know, shared the same vision. So,
So this is the first time that you have like NCFCA Moot Court has had like their own packet to be debated for Moot Court.
I think in the inception of NCFCA, maybe the first 3 years or so, we wrote our own packet. I don't know who was responsible for the packet writing. But ever since that time, we have been kind of borrowing packets and editing them. So we have not had in a very, very long time our own original packet.
Right. Well, that's really interesting. Was it a tough process to write your own packet?
Oh my gosh. the hardest thing about writing a packet is that you have to be really familiar with the arguments before you start writing them. So, you know, the packet is not just the facts of the record, which are fun and easy to come up with, you know, funny, you know, there's that mushroom pun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I actually objected to. I don't know if I wanted a pun in the Supreme Court of Palladosa, but, you know, all for the memes. So, but the hardest thing was actually to read all of the case law and then come up with compelling arguments, because that's what the lower court's decision is comprised of, is you making up your own arguments. So familiarizing yourself with case law ahead of time, like long before the students even touch the packet, and being familiar enough to write a whole-on argument, that was probably the toughest part of writing the packet, for sure.
Wow. Yeah, I can just imagine like how hard that could have been. I couldn't have done it. You know, I haven't written many packets myself, so it was probably pretty hard. But I think before we get more in depth on like the specifics of, you know, moot court and like the cases in the packet itself, could you give me your classic Ethan Tong rundown of the facts of the record?
Oh man, I need a PowerPoint to do the classic Ethan Tong.
Right, but you can try your best.
Yeah. Okay, so the packet concerns a 32-year-old male named Kobe Mendax, who lives in the fictional 51st state of the United States, which is called Palladosa. In this state, the law is, if you are subject to a protective order, which I'll explain in a second, that means that you cannot have a firearm. So what happens in the packet is neighbors hear Kobe Mendax and his wife fighting in an apartment. The police come, and they, when he opens the door, his wife is all beaten up. And so they arrest him, and she goes to the judge and she says, could you put a restraining order, which is also called a protective order, a PO, on my husband because he's been abusing me? And so the judge grants the restraining order. Now, technically, the restraining order doesn't require a criminal conviction. There's no hearing, official hearing. And so this is just one person's word against another person. So he gets, you know, the PO gets placed on him, and according to the law, he loses his gun. So the first issue, I mean, it's addressed second, but the first issue in the packet that's listed really is the Second Amendment issue, which is, should he be stripped of his right to own a gun, even though he hasn't been convicted? It's just a he said, she said in a court of law. Can you still take away his gun? That's the Second Amendment issue. The First Amendment issue is after the police officers apprehend him after he's at a gun range, they find that in his car is a box of mushrooms, not the kind that you put in your cream of mushroom soup, but the kind of mushrooms that you, you know, consume if you want to feel even higher than when you eat a good cream of mushroom soup dish. And those kinds of mushrooms are illegal in the state of Palladosa. And so he is convicted of illegally possessing psilocybin. But the reason why he has psilocybin, which is the drug that's in these mushrooms, the reason he has it is because he works as a usher at a religious service that uses these mushrooms as their communion. So, you know, you thought King's Hawaiian rolls tasted good as your communion bread. Wait till you have psilocybin as your communion. You will be feeling something more than the Holy Spirit. But that's kind of the issue in this packet is, if this religion believes that they should use these drugs as part of their religious service, even though it violates the law of the land, who wins? Should the state win or should the religion win? That's the other issue. That concerns the First Amendment.
Wow, that was phenomenal. I enjoyed every second of it. But for mooters who are reading the packet, obviously they have to be familiar with the facts of the record. How much reading do you think that people should do, or how familiar should readers be with the facts of the record? Should they have it like all memorized? Should they have all the important concepts memorized? Or just like the packet in general, just going through all of the arguments? Just give me your thoughts on that.
Sure. My pro tip, free pro tip without a coaching session that I tell most of my students. Actually, I haven't told you this yet, Luke. So actually, this is a pro tip for you. I suggest flashcarding the facts of the record. So whatever issue you're on, you should read through the facts of the record, highlight things that you think might be asked of you by the judge and turn them into flashcards, whether that's physical flashcards or a Quizlet. When you flashcarded them out, then you can start memorizing them so that during rounds and a judge asks you, you know, what was the legislative process like behind the House Bill 831 being passed into law? You can just quickly off the top of your head say footnote 3 tells us that Mothers Against Magic Mushrooms was a lobbying group that was organized to stop psilocybin, and they wanted this bill to be passed into law. That kind of knowledge comes through flashcarding. So write down all the important relevant facts of the record on a flashcard and then just get memorizing those.
So it could be like dates, it could just be terms.
Yes.
I guess like footnotes, all of that.
Yes. Everything that you think, I tell my students, if there's a above like 30% likelihood that you could reference it at least one round during the year, you should write it down. You don't want to put everything down, but typically people are too underjudicious and they're not very generous, so they're too stingy. They take too little facts of the record out. And then I forgot to say, on one side should be the fact. On the other side should be the citation. So, you know, on one side should say, two legislators said that there was an increase in use of psilocybin. On the other side of the flashcard should say, footnote 3. Or on one side it says, Kobe Mendax lives in a high crime neighborhood. And on the other side it should say, page 6, paragraph 1. So that you know exactly where it's coming from.
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty good technique. I'll have to use that. Thank you for telling me that now. But with learning about Moot, there's also case law that you have to read and become familiar with. And with case law, is that something that you should just go berserk on, just read all of the cases possible? And when you do that, should you read like all of the cases as many times as possible? Is there a certain number that you should read, or should you not read them so much? Kind of a confusing question, because I made it confusing.
No, I can't.
I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yes. I have two different messages for two different kinds of people. If you are the kind of person who doesn't want to read case law, then I would tell you that you need to go Luke's equivalent of going berserk. You do need to read some more case law, in the sense that it is necessary for you to read at least some aspects of the most important case law. And how do you know what's the most important? Well, you could get a coaching session from me. You don't need a coaching session. You could just look at the facts of the packet and see which cases are cited the most. Rahimi gets cited all the time. Bruin gets cited all the time. Heller gets cited a little bit for a little portion. That is the portion you should look up in your research. So you should research Rahimi, Bruin, and the little portion of Heller that is referenced in the packet. The second message is for the people who really want to read a lot of case law. For those of you who are interested in constitutional law and want to read for days and days, I would say you want to be efficient and not just have a wide quantity of cases that you read. Because for the most part, you're not going to reference your knowledge throughout the year. If you read this niche, you know, element in United States versus Kays, which is a Western District of Oklahoma case, you're not probably going to reference it hardly ever during the season. So instead of trying to read really thoroughly every single case, you should close read the important cases. So slowly read them, trying to pick out the important things and understand it the best that you possibly can. That's what I would suggest for the people who are more interested in going berserk, as they would say.
Right. And that would be like people who are probably more advanced or want to be more advanced mooters, and those who are interested in doing decent in Moot, but still aren't at the level of interest that they want to go all out, dedicate hours and days of their week just reading Moot, right?
Which you do not need to do. Like, always tell my students, Moot Court is not the kind of activity that you need to spend like 10 hours a week on. You don't even need to spend 5 hours a week on it. I would say that top quality Moot teams can get away with, even if you're not that good of a debater, you can get away with spending like 1 hour a week if you do it in like 8 weeks leading up to the tournament. Because putting in 8 hours of work will certainly get you prepared enough to compete well at a tournament. So you don't even need to put a ton of effort in, as long as you're putting in consistent time and not just cramming it all at the end.
And it ultimately comes down to time management, I think, and how they manage your time. And an aspect of time management with Moot Court is deciding what things are important to focus their attention to. So you brought up a couple of things. You brought up, you look through like the footnotes or the references to see which cases are cited more often, and then you should focus on those cases the most. And so for the mooter, their focus should be primarily on, at least for Second Amendment, the ones that you brought up. It could be like, I think you brought up Heller just a little bit, Bruin and Rahimi. Those are like the key ones that Second Amendment should focus on, right?
Yes, yes. Secondarily, you should also look into Harrison on Second Amendment, but...
Right. Harrison's pretty good. But for First Amendment, I'm not familiar with First Amendment, even though I'm rebuttal, but I should be. So can you refresh me now with First Amendment?
Yeah, the cases to look up on First Amendment are... There's a lot more. I think if you are First Amendment, your partner needs to take you out for... I was going to say drinks, but I don't even drink, so that... That was not applicable there. Your partner needs to take you out for a Whataburger.
A coffee, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Sure, a coffee. Because First Amendment people are at much more risk of burnout because there's a lot more to read. So on First Amendment, the cases that you should read are, of course, you should read Smith. You should read the cases that lead up to Smith. So that would be Yoder. So Wisconsin versus Yoder, Sherbert versus Verner. And then for the... in a related but not quite Smith area, you should read Church of the Lakumi, and then Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. And then you can leave behind, you can ignore Tandon versus Newsom and Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn versus Cuomo. And you can kind of ignore Fulton and you can kind of ignore Reynolds. Sorry, you can kind of ignore Janus, not Fulton. Don't ignore Fulton. You can kind of ignore Janus and you can kind of ignore Reynolds. But that's kind of the tier list of your cases. There are different tiers that you should read your cases in, and not all of them are in the S tier.
Right. This interview has secretly been a way to steal a 30-minute coaching session.
You're 16.
But with case law, there should be like a strategy, right, to like reading the case law that you mentioned. What's an effective way to like have your notes and do it in a way, maybe it's like the flashcard method that you brought up earlier. Is that like a suitable way to remember case law that you want to reference later? Or if not, what's a suitable alternative?
Oh, I have not thought about using the flashcard method for case law, partially because I don't know what you would write on the other side. Because, of course, you write the quote on one side. You know where the quote is from. That's not what you have to memorize. I think if you were to use the flashcard method, you would put on one side, here's where I would use this quote. So, like, question, what about fake religions? And then on the other side, you would say, as United States versus, I don't know. I don't actually remember the answer to that question.
Yeah.
You know, you'd put on the other side where you would find the answer to what to do with fake religions, a quote on the other side. But I think the most efficient way to read case law is to read the syllabus, see which parts you want to read and which ones you want to cut out, because you don't want to read everything. And then go to those sections, copy and paste any quotes that you think might be usable, and just put them in a quote book, just like kind of like a brief, basically, except you don't need to do extensive citations. But you just copy and paste a couple of quotes and then just generally get the gist of the case. And when you're done, look at all those quotes and cite them. So you should probably be citing as you go. The citation is simple. It's just name of the court, the number, the page number, which is found on the left-hand side. When you're scrolling on case text, you'll find the page number on the left-hand side. So name of the case, page number, and then if it's a concurrence or a dissent, you just write concurrence or dissent, and that's it. The citation is very short. A quick, funny story. Patrick McDonald, who has worked with me many times, and we were on the same mock trial team at Hillsdale, so that was fun. Patrick, I was looking through his old moot briefs, and he's so silly because he wrote down the credentials of the justice as if somebody would question. You quoted something from Justice Kagan. I don't think she's a credible source. And then you would have Justice Elaine Kagan has served on the Supreme Court for 13 years and was the associate justice. Like, you don't need to do citations like that. The citation should be very, very short. It should just be case name, page number, and if it's a dissent or a concurrence. That's it.
Right. Well, Patrick McDonald won moot court, so I think maybe there's some validity to that strategy.
Not because of that, but yes.
I like something that you mentioned towards the start of towards the start of your answer, and I'd like you to expand a little bit more. You mentioned how with the flashcard method, you were exploring it a little bit more. You said that on one side you could say This is like the question that someone may ask. And then on the other side, it's like the citation or the quote from the source. Would you suggest prepping the answer or the questions that justices are going to ask you? And then in doing so, you should probably have like a quote or a citation from some case. Is that like probably an ideal moot court strategy?
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. You know, in affirmative briefs for TP, where they'll have a little like A slash T section where it's like answer to,
yeah,
and it's whatever, you know, solvency disadvantage. That's basically what you could do with moot, where you're like, answer to, how do I deal with the fact that I don't want domestic violence victims to die? And then on the reverse, you would say Rahimi concurrence. And you would just like, you know, have some quotes from the Rahimi concurrence.
Right. So with that, I think there might be an aspect of memorizing or at least learning the concepts. But I asked Michael Ferris this question when I was interviewing him on moot court. And he said that memorizing is not a good presentation technique. Instead, you should focus on learning the concepts themselves and learning where you're going with the concepts that you're referencing instead of actually memorizing the answer. And so would you say that those two things kind of go hand in hand with memorizing and learning the concepts? And is learning the concept just memorization is just a side effect of learning the concepts?
Well, Michael Ferris is a nobody, so I would like to discard his... I'm just kidding. I'm never going to get an internship with Asia's LDA anymore. No, I obviously respect Mike Ferris a lot. The disagreement I would have with him is not in probably his motivation behind why he said don't memorize, but... I think we both agree it's bad to memorize things if you're just going to stick to your script and just kind of relentlessly say what you've planned to say, even if it's not what the judge is asking you. Where memorization is helpful is that people read off their script anyway. So if you are the kind of person who is reading off your script during rounds, is it better to read or to memorize? It is better to memorize. What Mike Ferris is saying is it might be better to have those concepts in your head and then be able to present ad lib just staring at the judges the whole time without any notes, without having memorized it like a robot. And I think that might be true. Also, difference. Mike Ferris is a brilliant rhetorician. And if you have impeccable on-the-spot rhetoric, then of course you can deliver things not memorized. But if your rhetoric on the spot is, judge, like, I would say that one of the things that, like, you know, Your Honor would, if I were to disagree with your question, Your Honor, like, if your rhetoric is not very polished, if it's very colloquial, you will struggle with sounding professional in front of the court. So it would be better for you to memorize than to ad lib, because you'll just sound like a debater. So I kind of disagree, kind of agree. There are points. I think in general, you should memorize. Most high schoolers should memorize, because if your alternative is reading from a script, it is better to memorize.
Right. The key difference is constitutional lawyer versus high school speech and debate.
Exactly.
That's a big difference to highlight there.
Big difference.
But with the time that we have remaining, I'd like to kind of go over a little preseason strategy that you can maybe lay out. Because, you know, like the moot court season is about to begin. The first tournament's a little over a month away. I was telling my moot court partner that I was like, we only have a month and a half to get ready and all of that. And we're still finishing up some cases. But, what would you say is like an effective moot court strategy besides, you know, reading the cases themselves? Let's say that you have the head knowledge. What are maybe some practice techniques that you can do, or some maybe like some documents to prepare, anything preparatory for the moot court season?
Yeah. The best help I can give you is to hone your moot court imagination. So, you know, this is a great bow tied to this interview, because I started by talking about how the great tip that I learned from high school debate is to be a self-aware speaker. Being a self-aware mooter is not just about your speaking, but also about your questions and answers. What kinds of questions can you anticipate that the judge might ask you? When you have those questions in mind, you are able to be much more prepared than if you just read a lot of case law. It is better for you to know that the judge might ask you questions about, how do you deal with the fact that Mr. Mendax almost certainly beat his wife? Do you really want to give him a gulp? That kind of question, you've never heard a judge ask that, but if you're thinking, judges might question me on that, then you can already start to think, what would my answer be? what kind of case law could I incorporate into my answer? So if you don't hone your moot court imagination, you will go in cold and go in blind and have no idea what kinds of questions the judge will ask. If you just sit down for an hour, even half an hour, and just think, what are some questions the judge might ask, and write them down. And then the next day, spend another half an hour, another hour, saying, how would I respond and what case law would I incorporate? You will be more prepared than 50% of your competition. And that is a guaranteed number, Blackstone warranty approved. Of course not. Yes, it is definitely going to help you be prepared, though.
What would you say is the difference between honing your moot court imagination and preparing your answers?
The moot court imagination starts with thinking outside of the box and being creative about what kinds of questions the judges might ask. And also, you know, stepping into the mindset of a parent, because a parent's mind is a little bit different from a high school student's. So you can prepare answers, but if you haven't thought of all the possible questions that you might get asked, that's where you're going to be lacking compared to people who are more prepared.
So it would be more of a, instead of having all of the physical knowledge, like let's say you have a document in front of you, you have a set of questions that judges are most likely to ask you. You have all of these laid out, you have all the citations and the responses that you have in mind, but you haven't actually properly thought through the process of the judge. And so because of that, you're not exactly sure, I guess, like what the judge's purpose behind that question is, or you're not exactly sure what that thought leads down in the grand scheme of the judge's perspective of the debate.
Yeah. So
is that, I guess, more specific of like the differences between preparing your answers and having a good moot court imagination?
Yeah, this might help, this clarification. So if you just have a list that says, here's the judge's question, here's my answer, that's a good start. You need to start with that. The second step, using your imagination, is also to say, what might the judge say to my answer? Because most briefs, if you're going to call moot court briefs, are not going to go beyond that first answer. So you're going to have the question and then the answer, and then you're just going to do a different question and a different answer. What if the judge doesn't like that? Where might they be picky about that answer? When you've figured out and you've read that answer and you said, okay, that seems persuasive, but the judge might still be wondering about this, how would I respond to their follow-up question? That involves your moot court imagination.
So maintaining your moot court imagination is more of a continuous process of honing your answers and understanding where the questions are coming from.
Yeah, getting the back and forth and going deeper than just first question, first answer.
Right. I think that goes back to the nature of, I guess, like what Supreme Court, you know, questions and answer was. It's to facilitate a discussion in order to see what the truth actually is. And so that's a really good point to end this discussion on today, Ethan. Thank you so much for joining me.
I am so happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Luke.
Yep. And of course, if you want coaching, go head over to Blackstone Moot Court, or I think Lasting Impact. There's also some options to get coaching from Ethan as well. Besides that, thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you next time.